no future. There's no livelihood. It's a really a ripe ground for any radicalization to occur.
It's Friday, October 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The UN Special Rapporteur says Myanmar's Rohingya crisis could fuel extremism. Thailand bids farewell to its longtime king. Dozens die in a fireworks explosion in Indonesia. And we preview President Trump's trip to Asia. That's all on today's VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. The UN's Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar has warned that the Rohingya crisis could fuel extremism in that region. Speaking at UN headquarters in New York, Young Hee Lee said mistreatment of the Rohingya minority offers a fertile field for extremism to take hold. She warned that the crisis could expand beyond its current location of Rakhine State and the border region.
If you consider these decades of discrimination in law and practice and in policy, decades against the Rohingya, and there's no future, there's no livelihood, it's really a ripe ground for any radicalization to occur.
Ms. Lee criticized Myanmar's de facto leader, Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, saying that Suu Kyi's statements so far have not carried enough weight, either internationally or domestically.
She has not ever recognized that there is such people called Rohingya, and I think that's a starting point. And I'm very disappointed that if she could use her moral power and her popularity to reach out to the people and say, hey, you know, these people are suffering, they have suffered a lot, and let's show some humanity. That would have, I think, people would follow her.
The special rapporteur also called on the UN Security Council to pass a resolution on the crisis.
It would be important for a Security Council resolution to really state that all of these Tatmadaw, the security forces and violence, acts of violence must stop, and all parties must be accounted for.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims have crossed the border to neighboring Bangladesh since August 25th, when coordinated Rohingya insurgent attacks on security posts sparked a ferocious counteroffensive by Myanmar's army. More than half of the nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees who have fled into Bangladesh over the years are children. AIDS groups are stressing the importance of a return to stability, including going back to school. Steve Sanford spoke to aid workers and students in the refugee camps outside Cox's Bazar.
Here in Balukali Refugee Camp, learning English under a safe roof is comforting for the children. Sisters Fatima and Ayla, who were driven from their home in Rakhine State last month, are happy to recite their latest lesson.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z.
It might all seem pretty basic, but the underlying process is a little more complex, says Jean-Jacques Simon of UNICEF.
The learning centers give children who have just come through the border some sort of a normalcy, or a way back to it at least. And on top of that, obviously they're learning, they're together, they're kids, they're being kids, and they're under this protective environment, which is their learning center.
On the other side of the border, in Myanmar, an estimated 60% of Rohingya children have never seen a classroom. Students in poverty-stricken Rakhine State are prevented from traveling to nearby village schools because of government restrictions imposed after the 2012 riots in Rakhine State.
The students cannot go to school, so they have lost their education. Even though there is a school in the other village, they cannot travel because we are so afraid to leave the village. It is not safe to go out for the children.
Human rights groups say the laws are a deliberate move to further constrict the basic rights of the Muslim minority.
For many, many years, the Myanmar authorities have systematically denied the Rohingya population access to education. And this has been part of an overall policy, in our view, that has been highly destructive, deliberately destructive, to this community of people.
As many Rohingya children are experiencing school for the very first time, those on the Myanmar side of the border wonder if they will ever get the same chance. Steve Sanford for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
For more on the story, you can log on to our website, voanews.com. You can also post your comments to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Here's some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Hundreds of thousands bid farewell to Thailand's former king. Nearly 50 are killed in explosions in a massive fire at Indonesia fireworks factory. Airport videos show four men also suspected in Kim murder. Pakistan mocks U.S. military mission in Afghanistan. And Taiwan's president calls for breakthrough in relations with China. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people surrounded the Thai royal palace, and millions more gathered at shrines around the country on Thursday to bid their final farewells to their revered king, Phumipun Adulyadet, after a year of official mourning. Dressed in black and amid tight security, 7,500 guests at the Grand Palace, including royals from as far afield as Britain, Bhutan, and Lesotho, also looked on as smoke began billowing from a spectacular 50.28-meter-tall pyre. King Wachiralongkorn Bhumibol's son presided over the pageantry culminating in Thursday's cremation. He was often flanked by other members of the royal family and Thai elites from the military and from civil society. Hundreds of thousands of black-clad mourners looked on, including Natawut Jitrayuat. He said, "The king has returned to the heavens like before. I'm very happy that now he can take a rest after his hard work for all Thais. But I feel that he's still here when I see pictures of him. I feel that he's still with the Thai people." King Phumipun ascended to the throne in 1946 after the death of his elder brother and was among the world's longest-serving monarchs when he died. He was widely regarded as a demigod by his subjects, who had nothing but praise for his rule. Official mourning is due to end in November when Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha is expected to face increased pressure to call elections and ease restrictions on political freedoms imposed after the military seized power in a coup in May of 2014. You're listening to VOA Asia. We have this news alert from VOA Asia. Firefighters in India's financial capital, Mumbai, on Thursday said a fire which broke out during a demolition drive in a slum near a busy railway station has been brought under control. The chief of the Mumbai Fire Brigade said firefighters had surrounded the area to douse it. He said there were no casualties and rescue operations are still underway. You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Next week, U.S. President Donald Trump will embark on a 12-day trip to Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, where he will attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, and the Philippines. VOA correspondent Brian Padden's reporting that the United States' key military allies in the region are expected to handle the president with care and focus on areas of mutual agreement, especially regarding North Korea, when they host Mr. Trump.
During his first official visit to Asia, President Trump plans to advocate for increased international support to pressure the Kim Jong-un regime to give up its nuclear weapons. Preventing North Korea from developing a nuclear-armed missile that could reach the U.S. mainland has become a top national security priority for Trump.
He's raised all kinds of expectations about what he is going to do about North Korea. And if he doesn't do those things, then it threatens his identity, it undermines him, it undercuts him.
The Trump administration has worked with China and Russia in the United Nations to pass tougher economic sanctions that could reduce North Korean trade by 90% and oil imports by 30%, and also imposed unilateral restrictions as well. However, U.S. military allies Japan and South Korea have been split over Trump's emphasis on the possible use of military force and his threatening fire and fury rhetoric to totally destroy North Korea if provoked. In Japan, Trump will meet and likely golf with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, perhaps his closest friend in Asia.
President Trump and Prime Minister Abe also agree on a number of issues, including in particular on the North Korea problem to a very large extent.
Japanese public support for Abe's strong stance on national security was bolstered after North Korea conducted two missile tests that flew over Japanese airspace and helped his conservative coalition recently win a decisive victory in an early parliamentary election. Yet while Abe has voiced staunch support for Trump's maximum pressure policy, officials in Seoul have quietly indicated that the threat of force is a diplomatic tactic to force concessions from North Korea and China. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is also expected to emphasize his country's long-standing ironclad U.S. alliance when he meets with Trump in Seoul. However, the liberal South Korean leader has openly opposed any use of force on the Korean Peninsula that could engulf the region in a devastating war.
I think Trump's visit is an opportunity to educate him in terms of how South Koreans see this and the fact that South Korea has been living under a credible threat of North Korean nuclear attack for a while now, and we're all doing fine.
Trump has characterized Moon's past efforts to engage North Korea in dialogue as unworkable appeasement. For now, differences between Seoul and Washington have been muted in the face of North Korea's continued missile and nuclear tests and Pyongyang's refusal to engage in inter-Korean talks or even accept offers of humanitarian aid from the South. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A North Korean diplomat says that Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho's recent warning to the UN General Assembly of a possible atmospheric nuclear test over the Pacific Ocean should be taken literally. Ri Yong-pil told the cable news network the country's foreign minister is very well aware of the intentions of leader Kim Jong-un, and North Korea has always brought its words into action. Bruce Bennett is a senior international defense researcher with the RAND Corporation. He told VOA's Victor Beatty he believes the threat is credible.
North Korea believes that until it does an atmospheric test with a missile, that it will not be perceived as a nuclear power. And therefore, that's a key task they've got to do, is to put a nuclear weapon on a missile and fire it out over some place and detonate it in order to be taken seriously as a nuclear power.
Can it be stopped?
Well, I think it can. There's at least some chance it could be if the U.S. were prepared to put the right kind of pressure on Kim Jong-un.
What would be the fallout, literally, of such a test?
The risk is that if they launch it out over the Pacific, as the foreign minister had previously said, that the Pacific has got lots of ships and lots of planes flying through it. If they detonate a very large nuclear explosion over the Pacific, there's a reasonably high chance that they could sink some ships or shoot down some aircraft. And if that happens, that's an act of war. That raises some really concerning questions about how the U.S. would need to respond.
Well, the U.S. Navy on Wednesday said a third aircraft carrier strike group is now sailing in the Asia-Pacific region. What do you make of that?
Well, the aircraft carriers are important. They could launch strikes. The escort ships for them are equally important because it's those escort ships that carry missile defense interceptors that could be used potentially to shoot down a nuclear warhead or a missile carrying a nuclear warhead before the warhead detonates. And that would clearly be a preferred outcome. North Korea would obviously prefer to avoid that, but it's not necessarily going to know where all the ships are.
Trump administration officials, including Defense Chief Jim Mattis, who will be in South Korea Friday and Saturday, are preaching diplomacy. But Michael Swain of the Carnegie Endowment said, while he's hopeful of averting conflict, I don't see any clear signs that there is progress in either coercing the North Koreans into starting to talk about denuclearization or finding some other path towards some kind of engagement with Pyongyang.
I think we have not seen much in the way of progress. If you want to have progress towards an agreement, you've got to convince Kim Jong-un that he really needs the agreement. The principal way you're going to do that is through some form of information operation, some form of information sent into North Korea or extracted from North Korea that will be very bothersome to him. And we do not seem to be mounting, at least publicly recognized, information campaign against North Korea.
That's Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation. He's a senior international defense researcher speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Both President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un congratulated China's President Xi Jinping on his new 5-year term and the inclusion of his name and political thought into the Communist Party's constitution. This is VOA Asia.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA Asia continues. I'm David Byrd in Washington. More than 4 decades after selling 1,000 Volvos to North Korea, Sweden is still trying to get paid for the cars. The vehicles were part of a $131 million trade package delivered to Pyongyang in 1974 during a period of openness. But North Korea never paid anything on the deal. That leaves a debt that has now accumulated with interest to $328 million, according to the Swedish Foreign Ministry. Per Åke Froberg of Volvo said that it sold approximately 1,000 of its 144-model sedans to North Korea. He said he did not know what else was included in the deal, but the Swedish government was also unable to say what was part of that transaction. Froberg said the sale of the Volvos was insured through the Swedish Export Credit Agency, EKN. He said when North Korea failed to pay for the cars, EKN stepped in, meaning that Volvo did not suffer any financial losses, and the deal was considered closed. North Korea owes millions elsewhere in Europe from purchases made during the early 1970s when Pyongyang was expanding economic relations with the West. Meanwhile, the Swedish furnishings company IKEA has withdrawn an ad in China that featured a mother who threatened to disown her unmarried daughter after it unleashed a wave of criticism on social media for being sexist and insulting to single women. The 30-second advertisement showed a family dinner scene where a Chinese mother declared sternly to her somber-looking daughter, "If you cannot bring back a boyfriend, don't call me mom." A young man then appeared at the door with flowers, and the delighted parents set up their dining table with IKEA tableware and decorations. The scene ended with the tagline, "Celebrate every day's life." IKEA apologized for the advertisement after critics said it stigmatized China's single young women who were colloquially known as the leftover women, a term coined to refer to professional females who have not married by their late 20s. But it's not only IKEA that caught blowback. In July, German luxury car maker Audi came under fire from consumers in China for an advertisement that compared buying a second-hand car to checking out a bride-to-be. This news alert from VOA Asia. A Chinese activist who was imprisoned after speaking out about women's rights and Hong Kong's democracy movement has been released after serving 3 years in jail. Su Changlan, a 47-year-old primary school teacher, was first detained in southern Guangdong province in October of 2014 after she made comments on social media in support of democracy protests in Hong Kong. You're listening to VOA Asia. The U.S. Department of State estimates between 600,000 and 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders each year. Millions more are enslaved within national borders. But as June So and Carol Pearson tell us, a grassroots effort to raise the awareness of the crime of human trafficking called Artworks for Freedom is taking place right here in Washington.
24 photographic images and words stop passers-by at Washington's DuPont Circle. Each image, end quote, from men, women, and children who were trafficked as sexual and labor slaves, challenges viewers to imagine the daily horrors and desperation of the victims.
Sorry, I'm trying not to cry. It's very moving, and it's disgusting, and it's very real. But I'm definitely glad I stopped, and I hope that I'll take more of this with me than when I came, so that, you know, I can make a difference, even if it's just by abstaining from a practice or a clothing line or something that might actually hurt someone else.
I feel something now, so I'm aware. I was aware of the problem before, but it kind of hits home when you see it so visually, like this exhibition. Obviously, some of these trafficked victims are exploited to make product cheap.
Award-winning photographer Kay Chernish created the collage and constructed images from her photos of trafficked persons.
I was first introduced to the issue of human trafficking through an assignment I had for the State Department. This was back in 2005. I was sent to Hong Kong, Macau, Thailand, India, and Italy to photograph all different kinds of human trafficking at that time.
Gripped by these human rights violations, Chernush continued to work in different countries, partnering with anti-trafficking NGOs. The first bought and sold outdoor exhibit was held in The Hague in 2009, then traveled to other cities in the Netherlands.
That was the genesis of Artworks for Freedom. If photography could be that powerful, not only in moving audience perceptions, but also empowering survivors, why not bring in other artists besides photography?
Other artists joined the anti-trafficking campaign using their own mediums, including dance, to depict the journey of trafficking victims from trauma to healing and recovery.
I think it makes a bigger impact through empathy. That's what I'm trying to do with my dance piece, is to create an empathetic environment of the individual stories. And I think through that, that's going to touch people even more than just reading dry facts.
The exhibits have been shown in major cities in many parts of the world. The Washington campaign also presents art from migrant workers' children and quilts made by trafficking survivors. 12 golden doors, transformed from battered wooden doors, are a metaphor for reclaiming the victims' lives.
Our goal with Artworks for Freedom is really to create awareness of human trafficking. This is something that we can eradicate in our lifetimes, and everybody has a role to play. Everyone can do something.
For producer June So, I'm Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Now you can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can also download our podcast and take us with you. You can find us at voanews.com and let us hear from you. VOA Facebook and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and a special thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I want to give a shout-out in Myanmar on Facebook, VOA Burmese, and also to the voice of Changzheng, Star Radio FM 88.3 at Changzheng Christian University in Tainan, Taiwan. Enjoy your weekend. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington.